Welcome to your third class on Britain since the Romans, and we somewhere in the 14th century. And I was just speaking at the end of last week about the Black Death, that terrible plague where 20 to 40% of British. British people died. Now every cloud has a silver lining, and the silver lining, if you like, in England at the time, it was wages, because with the death of so many people, there was a shortage of workers to in the farms, etc. And when there's a shortage of workers, wages go up. And so this was a very particular thing, and it led to something for the very first time in history, where the king intervened. To try to limit the rise in wages. It sounds very familiar, this. I think something happening in Paris this week on this. But the very first time, 1351. In 1351, there was the Statute of Labour. The Statute of Labourers. Indeed, we have some examples here. In 1348, the farm labourers were getting 1 penny a day in this particular part of England. 2 years later, they were paying 2 or 3 pence a day. And so they complained to the king, who was Edward III, and Parliament decided to pass, this is the king's parliament, not a democratic parliament, the Statute of Labourers Act. And this made it illegal for employers to pay wages above the level of 1346. Now, this was not necessarily very effective, because many employers continued paying more because they just absolutely needed to get the workers. But what was interesting about it is it was the first time that the national government had intervened to try to change wages. Many of the serfs in Britain were not allowed to leave the village that they were in. That was illegal. But the authorities had some problems, because if they executed people who broke the law, well, that just made the labour shortage worse, really. So they were a bit stuck. Social unrest after the Black Death led to a big revolt, and a very famous revolt, in 1381. The Peasants' Revolt of 1381, and this is a huge thing, and interestingly enough, there was actually a pop song written about it about 20 years ago, so it's not been completely forgotten. This was the poll tax, which was not the poll tax under Margaret Thatcher, but when Margaret Thatcher brought in a new tax, which was the same price for every adult. Its official name was the community charge, but rapidly everybody who didn't like it called it the poll tax, in the same name of the 1381 tax. The revolt began. It was a very impressive revolt, because it's much more difficult to revolt in the 14th century, not just because you'll probably be executed, but also because, Facebook didn't work so well, and you had to actually walk to the next village and tell people to revolt. So the revolt began when one village refused to pay the tax and threw the tax collector in the river. The rebels from Kent and Essex went to London. They broke into a prison and they released a radical leader, John Ball. I will tell you something about him in a while. They occupied the Tower of London and they executed the Archbishop of Canterbury. The king was obliged to negotiate, but when the leader of the rebels, Wat Tyler, here he is, when the leader of the rebels, Wat Tyler, went to negotiate, the king's soldiers killed him. And the revolt was crushed. Moral of the story, never trust a king. This revolt, so really a very big revolt across the whole of southern England, was very remarkable. And at this time, which is a very important thing to understand, but perhaps you already understand this, at this time you have to remember that religion and politics are the same thing. Now, that sounds really, really bizarre to us in the 21st century. But at this time, everybody sees the world in religious terms. So if you say, I want a different religion, it also means you want a different society. if you want a different society, you say, God wants a different society. That's the way people talk, yeah. And so, in fact, demanding social change and demanding religious change are actually completely the same thing. And one example is this gentleman who was released from the prison by the peasant revolt of 1381. This is John Ball, the radical priest. And the famous, the well-known quotation from John Ball was, "When Adam Dalf and Eva Span, who was then the gentleman?" Yeah, when Adam was digging the ground and Eve was spinning the clothes, who was the gentleman? Who was the aristocrat? So it's dans la Bible, ils sont où les aristos? Au début, ce que Dieu voulait vraiment. They aren't there, and so this was a very much a radical demand. And in fact, during this whole period, the demand, "Let's go back to the Bible," is actually today. If somebody says, "Oh, let's go back to the Bible," they say, "Oh, they're very conservative." At the time, they were revolutionary, because what they meant is, don't listen to the Pope, don't listen to the Bishop, don't listen to the priest, don't listen to the King. Go back to the Bible. And your own personal interpretation of it. So, radical religion terrified the elite. This had been going on for a while. For example, the Lollards were a religious movement, and they were around for a couple of hundred years. And they said that the Roman Catholic Church has been corrupted. And the lavish, rich church fixtures, all the gold and the statues, should be sold, and they should be used to help the poor. And also, the Lollards said that, you know, everybody's a priest; everybody can get close to God, not just the priests. And they said there is no the priests have no special authority. They also translated the Bible into English. Now, translating the Bible into the vernacular was a revolutionary act in this period, because it meant everybody can read the Bible and understand it and interpret it and choose the bits you like. The Bible is very varied. Everybody has bits they like. Yeah, and therefore, it was a challenge to the church. The church's idea was, no, the Bible is in Latin. So the bishops and the priests understand it, and everybody else, if you have a question, you ask us. So they were a very, very important thing. And this is one of their leaders. Of course, quite a number of them were horribly massacred. Very similar thing in France with the Cathars, and in what is now Czechoslovakia, in Bohemia with the Hussites. Here you have Wycliffe. It's the only thing I could find of Wycliffe, who's the guy who I think he may be being executed. It's the sort of thing that they would do to him. Yes. Okay. Now this is also the 14th century is also the moment when the first English literature, which is still widely read today, was produced, and this is the Canterbury Tales by Geoffrey Chaucer. This is interesting, because in Britain, if you're in high school, you might be in your literature classes. You might read the Canterbury Tales, and you probably wouldn't read anything before that. I studied it at high school, and it is remarkably modern. It really is. It's full of blood and sex and stuff like that. And in particular, it's in the form of. It's a story where a whole load of pilgrims on a pilgrimage meet up in a... Has anybody read it? No? Okay. Meet up in a tavern, and they tell each other stories to pass the time on their pilgrimage. And so there's two sections of it. There's the sections of it where he describes the group of people who are on a pilgrimage, and then there's the stories that each one of them tell. So, for example, there's a prioress who is the head of the convent. And she likes sex, really. It's all very suggestive. I think the friar is probably the best one. "A friar there was," this is a monk, "a friar there was, a wanton and a merry, a limiter, a very festive man. In all the orders four is none that can equal his gossip and his fair langage. He had arranged full many a mariage of women young, and this at his own cost." Now, I don't think it's too difficult to read between the lines. This is a monk, and he was so generous that regularly he paid for the weddings of young women. You're supposed to understand that there's a reason he wanted these young women to be married quickly, and he would pay the money. Yes, that he'd they were pregnant, and he was the father, and so he paid it. And this was the kind of indirect criticism of the church. The church was very much criticised at the time, but it has to be said the archbishops were extremely rich. I mean, millionaires, yeah? And also, many of the monasteries and convents were, let's say, not very Christian in activity. Now, this will be important, not essentially for moral reasons, but because the power of the church will become a problem for the rising merchant classes, for the commercial classes. And that's where we move on to with the next story. This is a bit more. This is still the Canterbury Tales, and it's written in a language which is a little difficult for people today. But it has been translated into French. This is obviously a picture of people on their way to hell. Yeah. Another video if you fancy it on YouTube. Middle Ages 4, the late Middle Ages. So let's move on to then the Reformation and the Civil War. So 1485 to 1688. Now we're getting into the areas that, you know, are certainly in the, I mean, to be pragmatic about this, in the Capes, if you didn't know much about the 14th century, that would not be, you could probably get away with it. But the Reformation, you're supposed to know the most important things that were going on here. And so the Reformation will have tremendous effects in Britain, which continue today. For example, Britain is a Protestant country today. The new Prime Minister is not the new Prime Minister, the funeral of the Queen, who's the head of state. The Prime Minister was involved, she read a lesson, and the Archbishop of Canterbury was the boss. And when Charlie gets crowned, it will be the Archbishop of Canterbury that does it. So the established church, we don't have a secular state like you have in theory, at least in France. So that's the first thing that comes from the Reformation. The second thing that comes from the Reformation is the constitutional monarchy. The way that they managed to break the power of the monarch and therefore make sure that the monarchy could continue. And that's kind of original and different. Now, I'm not usually a great believer in lists of kings, but in the Reformation it really does make a difference. You got Henry VIII. Let me summarise and then go back to the beginning. Yeah. Henry VIII, for political reasons, breaks with Rome and becomes the head of the church in England. But he is not a Protestant. He just wants the same church, but with him as boss. However, when he dies, his son Edward is very young, but he's surrounded by really Protestant advisors, and it becomes a Protestant church. Lady Jane Grey only lasts about 6 days. However, after only 8 years, Edward dies and Mary the First comes into power and she's a Catholic. And so she tries to turn things back, but there are things you can't turn back and things you can turn back. She only lasts 5 years, and Elizabeth is extremely lucky because she lasts 50 years. And she has time to do the biggest piece of work that needed doing for the establishment at the time. Oh yes, please do. but she stabilises the Church of England. And that will basically be the situation. James and Charles, however, will be tempted by both Catholicism and absolute power, which are seen together at the time. And this will explode in 42, and in 49 Charles is executed. And Britain becomes a republic for 11 years. But, you know, we had a good time for 11 years. So that's the summary. So let's go back to it. So you've got to begin with the idea then I'll come with that. That's in a moment. You've got to begin with the idea of the power of the church. It's not at all. Today, the church in most countries is an organizer of people's Sunday hobbies. That's not the case at all. The church was a massive landowner in Britain. The church had its own courts, its own tribunals. If you had a problem about testaments or marriage or inheritance, it was very often the court, the church tribunal. The church was a mass media. Everybody went to church on Sunday, and so what was passed around for the priest to announce on Sunday, to declare, was extremely important. Now, the church, of course, usually worked with the king, and the church, it was church and king together, as the establishment, you know, making sure, you know, that people didn't revolt in particular. Now, there were some, the church was huge. There were enormous numbers of priests and monks and friars, and they sometimes in conflict with each other. But basically, it was like a second state. It was like a parallel state, really. Also, the church levied its own taxes. People had to pay the tithe to the church. La dîme, comme on disait. And so, really, you've got this situation where you've got almost a parallel state. Also, I already mentioned that the three most complicated machines that people would ever see were the windmill, the clock, and the pipe organ, and two of these were only in churches. The senior church leaders were offered the younger sons of nobles. Yeah, so if you're a duke and you have two sons, the first one becomes duke, and the second one becomes a bishop. So it was all very implicated, and in some ways not that religious. I remember a few years ago I gave a class like this, and but concentrated on the Reformation, and the students at the end of the year were allowed to say, you know, what they liked and what they didn't like. And one student wrote, I would have liked the history to have been talked about without talking about religion. So, you know, that was kind of cute, but, you know, it was a bit hopeless. Now, there had been many attempts for reform, many demands for reform, and of course the Inquisition was one of the responses to reform. There were the taxes and so on. There had been plenty of criticism inside the church, in particular anti-clericalism, which is mostly about the fact that the church did not pay any taxes. So the commercial classes were particularly angry at the church because the church, one, did not pay any taxes, and two, often involved in commercial activity. It was unfair competition. And certainly after the introduction of printing at the end of the 15th century, then it was much more it was easier to spread radical ideas. So let's have a look at then the Reformation in general across Europe, and the big guy, the hero, is Martin Luther, if you like. He died in 1546, to give you an idea. He was born in 1483. And he challenged the authority of the Pope. He said the Pope's not so great. In fact, the Bible is the only source of religious authority, and all baptized Christians should be priests, should be considered as equal to priests. So this is extremely radical, whereas the theory of the Catholic Church at the time and still today is that the Pope gains his authority directly from God. And so what he says on religious matters is much more important than what I say or what any other ordinary person did. And so Luther said that salvation, if you want to go to heaven, you can only do this through faith in Jesus, and the church is not important. So this is a very central idea of Protestantism. Protestantism at the time was progressive in the sense that it said, what is important is your individual relationship with God. Catholicism said, you stay in your place. The Pope's there, and the Bishop's there, and the priest's there, and you're there, and you just stay in your place. Whereas Luther said, and Protestants in general said, that a personal relationship with God, and therefore a personal reading of the Bible. And this was a way of attacking the established church, extremely powerful established church. And two, the new commercial classes tended to like this idea. What is important is the individual. not their place in a fixed hierarchy, but the individual. So it was in many ways a religion which fitted capitalism. And we're at the very beginnings of capitalism, which fitted capitalism much better. It said, you know, what's important? It's the individual. It's what you do, which is an idea that has kept arising since. Now, what is new about Luther is not that he criticised the church, as I told you, the Wycliffeans in England and the Cathars in France and the Hussites in Bohemia, all critics, but they all got massacred. What is different is he won. That's what's new about Martin Luther is he won. And the fundamental reason that he won is because in Germany, the powerful commercial classes decided, yes, we're on his side. The previous ones in the 13th century Lollards in Britain, they didn't have a powerful class on their side. They were just a whole bunch of radical peasants, and they weren't allowed to go. The Cathars are very interesting, but I can't go into any real detail. The Cathars in France, they denounced infant baptism. They said, you know, you shouldn't baptize babies. They don't know why you're doing it. And they also fought against the sacrament of marriage. So Luther's time had come. He provided new ways of handling a new situation. There are lots of details. He was opposed to worshipping saints, for example. He said, you know, you can worship God, but don't worship the saints, because it's not in the Bible, also. And there were different Protestants, as Luther and Calvin and some others. For Calvin, the most important thing was to be opposed to to transubstantiation. Now, transubstantiation is a Catholic idea, and it's a very simple idea. It says that every Sunday, when you have the Mass, the priest takes bread and wine, and he performs a miracle and transforms the bread and wine into Jesus' body and blood, I'm sure. So, did anybody else have a religious upbringing except for me? Ah, les choses se perdent. I see, quand même. Faut me rassurer. C'est pas perdu. Okay, and so this is obviously something pretty big, a miracle every Sunday, and so priests must be pretty important people. Now, Calvin and many Protestants said, no, it's just a symbolic ceremony. Now, of course, if it's just symbolic, anybody can do it. And so this was, although it appears to be a very technical theological difference, is it really transformed or is it a symbol? It feels like it's difficult, there's no reason that should be so important, but in fact it meant, if it's only symbolic, priests are not so important, so everybody's important, so we don't really need a hierarchical church. Protestantism could be very radical, yeah? Nobody should have servants except God. This kind of idea. Nobody should have the establishment didn't like that idea. Nobody should have servants except God. They didn't like that idea at all. So some of the ideas I just mentioned. Some of these ideas of the Reformation against corruption in the church, for a personal relationship with God, less separation between priests and others. And this went into great details, and lots of Protestants we'll see in England were campaigning against the priests wearing special clothes. These are called vestments. And during in the Church of England, it was very interesting, once Elizabeth gets in, the big debate about how much special clothes is too many. Because if you have a lot of special clothes, like the Catholics do, lots of colours and incense and stuff, then it's like, oh yeah, right, priests are being presented as really superior. And so many Protestants say, well, no, this particular, you know, this kind of scarf that vicars wear, well, that's okay, and a black tunic, okay, that's okay, but nothing more. There's a big fight about what was the limit, which always, you know, looks a little bizarre for us. So this is interesting. So in fact, as you can see, these are theological or doctrinal differences, except for the first one, which is corruption is a more everyday thing. many Protestants said priests should get married. Now, this was not because they thought, oh, the poor priests, they must be so lonely. And indeed, marriage at the time was not, you were not supposed to be like friends with your husband or friends with your wife. That was not a deal. It was not part of the deal. It was companionate marriage is a later idea. Yeah. Today, if you marry somebody, we think, oh, well, we hope you've got lots to talk to each other about. You're like, a bit like best friends in a way. Yeah? Supposed to. That was not the idea at all. Nobody thought about marriage about like that. That wasn't the deal. That was later. This is an example of a practice which the Protestants denounced. They are selling indulgences. Now, indulgence is very simple. Perhaps you remember that in Catholic ideology, when you die, you can go straight to heaven. I don't think you will. You can go straight to hell. You probably won't. But normally, you will spend some time in purgatory, which is no fun, but you'll be okay afterwards and you go to heaven. So let's imagine you've done a certain number of sins. I apologise about this. He's done a certain number of sins. Oh, some people know about it, I can see. Yeah. And so let's imagine he's supposed to spend 100 years in purgatory before going to heaven. Well, I have here an indulgence. This is minus 50 years in purgatory. And for 100 euros, it's yours. That is really literally what selling indulgences was. It was about selling a reduction of your time in purgatory. And it was big money, because people really believe... I suspect that he's not going to give me the 50 euros. You know, I think he doesn't believe me. But people really did believe it. And that was an example of people used to think. So here we have Martin Luther. You can see this is a statue made some time later. But you can see that he was somebody's hero. Yeah. And what is he holding in his hand? Yeah, the Bible. Yeah, the book is. Yeah, this is becoming much more important. The book. There is Martin Luther. Here is a very bad map of the influence. The yellow is the this is where the different kinds of Protestantism manage. Yeah, so Anglicans in Britain, a little special. The Calvinists are in yellow, but you can see that in France they have not controlled France. They've just got representatives in France. And the blue is the Lutherans. So it's in particular Norway, Denmark and Germany where the Protestant Reformation is going to establish itself. The leader of the Reformation in Scotland is John Knox. And I don't know if you know, but the Church of Scotland is very different from the Church of England. In particular, the Church of Scotland is a Presbyterian church. That means that they run every parish by a committee, and there's no bishops. Most people don't care today, but we had wars about this. We had the Bishops' War at the time. So John Knox, the great leader in France, and I just got this photograph last month. This is Geneva, and these are the four heroes of the Reformation in Switzerland. Now, I can't recognise them, but one of them is Calvin, one of them is John Knox, and the other two are local guys whose names I've forgotten. But what you can't see about this is an enormous statue. It's much bigger than this room, and it's in the main park. It's a huge thing with lots of minor heroes underneath it. And the slogan that they use is "Post tenebras lux." After the darkness came the lights. In fact, in many countries, but certainly in Switzerland, the Reformation is a bit of a foundation myth. Just like in France, we say, you know, everything changed with the French Revolution. Let's put the slogan of the French Revolution above every high school in the country. The French Revolution is the beginning. Well, there it was, the Reformation, which was the beginning. So let's get back to England and this is the time, of course, of the Tudors. Now, everybody loves the... Actually, I hate it, but everybody else loves the television series. But from a historical point of view, although many of the things which happen in it are true, the main historian's criticism of it is it always puts court intrigue and personal conflict at the centre of what happens in history. And that's not true. Yeah, that's not true. It makes a better television. There's more blood. Yeah, because it is quite difficult to represent, you know, changes in religious doctrine. There's no blood. Yeah. So anyway, that's just a picture for me to allow me to say this. So let's have a look at the first of them. So Henry VIII. Now Henry VIII is a very ironic situation. In fact, because he was not a Catholic. Sorry, he was not a Protestant. In fact, he wrote a book to defend the idea of the Trinity, one of the central ideas of Catholicism that people were questioning. But he had a political problem, and his political problem was that he didn't have an heir. He didn't have a son. He didn't have a son, and you know how awful it is when you don't have a son, I guess. So, of course, it was very important to him at the time. And so he asked the Pope, can you cancel my marriage? So I could get another wife who will give me a son. Now, normally the Pope would say yes. He'd said yes before to other people. But there was already a conflict between the king and the church, connected with the immense power of the church and the commercial competition and so on. And so for this reason, at this point, the Pope said no. Henry hesitated for a long time because, you know, you don't want to break with the Catholic Church just because you feel you haven't had enough coffee on a Tuesday morning, you know. And so he hesitated, but then he decided he's going to break with the church, and he established himself as the head of the church in England. And notice that I did not say the head of the church of England. It's not the church of England yet. It's the church in England. So he was the same church, but just with himself as the head. I would do that. It sounds good. What happens yet? However, although, like I say, he's not a Protestant, immediately, because I have to say that, I mean, for the moment, everybody's in the same church, in the Catholic Church, but inside the church, there are reformers who have kind of Protestant ideas and traditionalists and so on. And so, let's say, once he declared that he was no longer working with the Pope, all the traditionalist bishops left for France. And they went off to France because they believed that the Pope was essential. And so all the reformers became the bishops in England. So although Henry was quite a traditionalist, the changes he meant the rise of the reformers in the church and the Protestants. Here is Henry VIII's favourite palace, Hampton Court Palace. You can go there. It's quite fun. And of course, the famous picture of Henry VIII is like that. I think it's very unfair because for many, many years he was thin, and then, you know, suddenly it's like people do at birthday parties. They take out the photograph of you, which is really bad, and show everybody, you know. So it's really rather unfair. But he's still quite magnificent. There he is again. Henry is known for having a complicated relationship with his wives. So he had six of them all together, and half of them died. I don't remember which ones died and which ones were executed. Who cares? But let's say that he was desperate to find an heir, and this led him to be less feminist than he might otherwise have been. But he also carried out two very, very important, a very, very important reform. Because he said, well, if I'm the head of the Church of England, well, maybe I could have, the church in England, sorry, maybe I could have some of the money. The monasteries, for example, are often criticised for corruption and rich living, and they have a lot of gold. So I'm going to pass a law to dissolve the monasteries, close all the monasteries, nationalise them if you like, close all the monasteries and take all the money for the king. And the land, they have a lot of land, the monasteries, I'll give it to my friends, you know, in the way that you do politically, so that, you know, to make sure they stay on your side, you give them lots of land. And so then it all became very economic, because a whole section of the elite had made a lot of money from the Henry's reforms. And therefore, you know, obviously didn't want it to change back. There was protest. The Pilgrimage of Grace is a revolt to defend the monasteries and to restore the old Catholic Church. It was a bloody revolt. I don't know as much about it as I would like to, but I don't need to today. The Pilgrimage of Grace, yes, it was a traditionalist Catholic revolt against Henry. But Henry eventually died like people do. There's when they dissolved the monasteries, they also tended to smash them up and smash up all the statues and just take the gold. And there's the Pilgrimage of Grace. That's a later, much later drawing of the Pilgrimage of Grace. And you can see, so what they're saying is, well, Henry is going against the will of God by dissolving the monasteries. So that's not okay. Henry died, and he was succeeded by Edward VI. And Edward VI was actually very young. I can't remember. I think he was 12 or something. And so, in fact, the kingdom was governed by his advisors, and his advisors were really Protestants, proper Protestants. And so they created a Protestant church in England. And the most important, I have to simplify, yeah, but the most important thing that they did to do this was to institute the Book of Common Prayer. Because there was a bit of a problem for the church in England, and that was that once Henry had said, okay, the Pope is not the boss anymore, or many, many different currents of thought were encouraged. So it looks like anything can change in the church. Well, this is what I think, and this is what I think. Lots and lots of pamphlets, some of them very radical, about what should change. The elite didn't like this idea of, oh, let's have a big festival where everybody has a new idea about what change. And so they wanted to stop that happening. And so what they did is they published the Book of Common Prayer, said in every church they must use this book and no other book. So this was mainly to stop more radical ideas of religion getting around. This Book of Common Prayer was definitely a Protestant book, so the remaining Catholics had to hide or go to France if they were rich. But of course, most ordinary people said, hey, the king says I should be a Protestant. Okay, I mean, life is just too complicated to be revolting all the time. But another important reform, priests were given the right to marry, and many of them did marry. And of course, the importance of that was priests are not so important. They're the same as everybody else. That's why they can marry. Yeah, so it takes away the speciality. Now, unfortunately, things could have occurred very differently if Edward had lived for 50 years. But he died when he was a young adult. After 6 years, he died. And that really, we could have had a whole different story. And he died, and he was succeeded by... Oh, sorry, here you have the Book of Common Prayer. Now, the Book of Common Prayer, not in this version, but in 90% of this Book of Common Prayer is still used today in the Church of England. So it's a successful book. Can I do this? That's a 1762 issue. I'm tired already. So Mary came to this thing. Now, Mary was also a daughter of Henry VIII by one of the other wives. And by a family accident, she had been brought up as a Catholic. That she just happened to be in France at the wrong time or the right time, depending on your point of view. And so she became queen. And so this was an accident, really, that she was the next person in line for the queen, and she was a Catholic. So if she'd been born after the next one, it would have changed things. She was a devout Catholic. She wanted Catholicism back. Now, why was she a Catholic? Well, that's hard things to explain, really, but certainly a general preference for traditionalism would encourage somebody to be a Catholic, and a general desire for change would encourage somebody to be a Protestant. But that's not the only thing involved, of course. And so, she re-established the link with Rome. The Pope is the Pope, and nobody else is the Pope. Married priests must leave their wives. She dissolved the marriages of the priests. Again, this was not such a shocking deal as today, because they didn't see wives in the same way, and set about burning a few heretics, or burning a few Protestants. However, she is not as somebody important said, politics is the art of the possible, and so she said, please support me. Dear aristocracy, please support me in re-establishing Catholicism. P.S. I will not give the lands you got back to the church. Because otherwise it was just impossible to stabilise the situation. Now, Mary is known in the comic books as Bloody Mary. And she did execute about 200 Protestants, maybe more. Huh? Which is fewer than Elizabeth. Or just a little more than Elizabeth. But the main thing about Mary is the Catholics lost, and so the Catholics aren't writing the history books. And that's why Mary is Bloody Mary, and Elizabeth is not Bloody Elizabeth, because somebody said, as long as lions don't have their own historians, all of the stories will be written from the point of view of the hunter. But, she's probably not that cool. So let's have a little look at her burning people. One of the big deals was Thomas Cranmer. Now, Thomas Cranmer was a church leader who was definitely a Protestant and refused this idea of returning to the church. And he was taken to prison, and they said, "We're going to execute you." And he was persuaded to sign a document saying the opposite. I think they probably gave him some tea and cakes or something, or tortured him. Probably one or the other. The Church of England has a lot of tea and cakes in its history. No tea and cakes. It was torture, yeah? Okay. And so he signed to say that the Pope was wonderful, that the Pope was the direct descendant of St. Peter. And for some reason, I don't understand everything. They said, "Well, yeah, we're going to execute you anyway. But first of all, we want you to give a talk in the Cathedral of Oxford to say that the Pope is the direct descendant of St. Peter." There's a big political thing. Let's have one of our previous enemies in Oxford Cathedral declaring that we are right. So this was a political coup, a big coup de com', and it was a disaster, because when he got to Oxford Cathedral, he said, "I regret signing. In fact, I declare here that the Pope is the Antichrist." On sent que ça va pas bien finir. Ils ont pu se trop tard. And he said, "And when they take me to the stake to burn me, I want my right hand to burn first, because this is the hand that signed that horrible piece." And so that's what they did. And so that was a spectacular thing. Now there's Cranmer, and you see the Cranmer's execution. This is a Protestant propaganda poster, of course. And there he is. So, can you see what's burning first, folks? Yeah, that was good. Now there was plenty of. Like I said, there were a few hundred. I'm not sure if it was 200, 300, something. Protestants burnt, later on, the Protestants in their books, this is the Book of Martyrs by Fox, which was an absolute bestseller. And in the 19th century, in every Protestant's house, that is the majority of houses, the Bible and Fox's Book of Martyrs. And here's a picture from it, and you can see that they're all being burned. In this particular story, the person being burnt is a pregnant woman, and her baby is born during the execution, and then the guards throw the baby back into the flames. It's a bit like Game of Thrones, really. The Fox's Book of Martyrs. There you go. "A lamentable spectacle of three women with a silly infant brasting out of the mother's womb, being first taken out of the fire and then cast in again. And so all burned together in the Isle of Guernsey, 1556, July 18th. Now, notice that because they're giving a specific date, it's probably basically true. It might not be true in every detail, but it's not a total myth. So you can see it was getting pretty hot. Luckily for the Protestants, Mary died after only 5 years. So she was pretty good at it. In 5 years, she killed hundreds of Protestants, whereas Elizabeth killed hundreds of Catholics, but over 50 years. So it's much more reasonable, really. Elizabeth was partly lucky because she lasted 50 years, and so it was possible to do the proper work of stabilising the church of England. The first thing that she did is she made it obligatory to attend Anglican services. If you didn't go to church on a Sunday in an Anglican church, you had to pay a fine. Now, some of the rich Catholics just paid the fine, you know, so if it's life, we'll pay the fine. She also wrote a new version of the Book of Common Prayer, and again imposed it. Every church must use the same Book of Common Prayer, but the new Book of Common Prayer took out some of the most controversial questions. So, for example, with the new Book of Common Prayer, if you want to believe that the communion is a miracle of transubstantiation, that's okay. And if you want to believe it's a symbol, that's okay. Let's not get people divided. So it's a very intelligent way of stabilising the Church of England. And that's still the case today. The Church of England is always known as a broad church. You can go to one Church of England, one Anglican church in Britain, and it looks really, you know, there's loads of statues and very complex, ornate, and it looks like a Catholic church. And you could go to another one, and it's very simple, it looks like a Methodist church. So the strength of the Church of England was to accept quite a wide variety of theological and doctrinal positions. And they put these down in the 39 articles. You have to believe these 39 things. Which was actually, for the time, this was quite a small number, in fact. Yeah, it could have been 163, it was only 39. Nevertheless, this involved continuing repression of Catholics and of dissenters. Now, this was religious, but it was also political, in the sense that at the time, the big enemy of England was Spain, and especially the rich Catholics were suspected of being allies of Spain and would encourage the Spanish if they invaded. And they tried to invade. In 1588, the Spanish tried to invade England, the Great Armada, but it didn't work. So the repression of Catholics changed with the times. Yeah, when Spain got more powerful, they repressed the Catholics more. And at some point, you could be executed for being a Catholic priest. Whereas at another period, you were just fined. Yeah, so the repression was political in aim, to make sure that there was no power base for Catholics, the Catholic power to rise again. On the other hand, she also repressed dissenters. Dissenters are the more radical Protestants. So we've not gone far enough. We need more reform. And some of these were really extreme left, but some of them were just doctrinally more radical. Now, the technical terms here are: a dissenter is somebody who thinks we need a new church outside the Church of England because the Church of England will never really change. A Puritan is somebody who wants to reform the Church of England and make it more Protestant. Now, the unfortunate thing about this is that everybody knows the Puritans who went to America. Technically speaking, they were not Puritans, they were dissenters. Because they wanted to abandon the Church of England because it was no good anymore. So from a technical point of view, is that they were dissenters rather than Puritans. But, you know, they've become known as the Puritans. One of my friends wrote in a history book that Elizabeth was not very harsh on the Catholics. But I went to a Catholic school, and they told us the other side of this story. And the period of Elizabeth is the period of the Catholic martyrs. For example, there are a few hundred. When we were at school, they told us the whole story of every one. Yeah, and they even got us to sing songs. And there's this amazing song: "Faith of our fathers living still in spite of dungeon, fire, and sword." Faith of our fathers living still in spite of dungeons, fire, and sword. And the most amazing line in it is: "How sweet would be thy children's fate if they, like them, could die for thee." Which is like, you know, I want to be a martyr too. It's like, just a minute. Excuse me, is this obligatory? And so they had all the children, this is in the 1960s, all the children singing, "We want to be martyrs," just like, anyway, that was all a bit sick, really. But here, there's Elizabeth I looking fabulous. It's so hard to get dresses like that these days. You should try Ashiem, yeah? Okay. The 39 articles of the Church of England, which are still, almost all of them are still in use today. And this is one of our good old Catholic martyrs from Lancashire, Edmund Campion. He doesn't look too happy about being a martyr. I don't know if you'd want to go out to a discotheque with him. These are all Catholic martyrs, John Southworth. So the very last king I'm going to talk about today is James the First. So this is a lot later, of course, 1603. So as I say, Elizabeth was very successful in stabilising the Church of England, as well as beginning the British Empire around the world. This is the time of Francis Drake, of the great pirates of the British Empire, and they brought back tobacco and potatoes and cool things like that from South America. So James the First, when he came to power, he was increasingly in conflict with Parliament, and he wanted more power for himself, and this went hand in hand with being soft on the Catholics. Because those in the elite who would support James to have more power were closer to Catholicism, because it went together a bit, absolutism and Catholicism. Because everybody looked to France and said, look at France, that's a proper Catholic country. Oh, not the king, he's got a whole shitload of power. I don't think that's what they said, but yeah, a whole lot of power. In any case, there were two events I want to mention from the religious point of view in James's reign. First of all, when the new king came to power, now, people have been waiting a long time, 50 years. When is she going to die, this Elizabeth? Sounds familiar. In any case, when she did, and the next king came along, of course, everybody was hopeful. The Catholics were saying, yeah, maybe the new king will be a bit easier on us, and it'll be possible. So it's very important to people to keep their own religion. It'll be possible to rebuild the Catholic Church. And the Puritans, who wanted a more Protestant church, maybe the king will be more Protestant than Elizabeth and go a bit further. And indeed, 1,000 of them produced the millenary petition. In fact, 1,000 priests or 1,000 religious people produced the millenary petition to ask for the Church of England to become more Protestant. And in particular, they wanted to get rid of these things. Look at that. Isn't that, if you're a real Protestant, you're supposed to hate this wedding ring. It's because of the arthritis, I have to have it on my little finger. The wedding ring. See, wedding rings are not in the Bible. And they're made of gold, it represents material wealth. And so the Protestants, it was very shocking that in the church there were wedding rings during the church ceremonies, and so that was one of the things they wanted to get rid of. And the other thing was all these vestments, all these ornate, luxurious clothes for priests, which is too Catholic. So they wanted to get rid of those. Now, in fact, James didn't do this. He didn't follow the millenary petition. He did not make these reforms, but he did do one thing, which most people thought was a pretty good thing to do. And he ordered a new translation of the Bible. And he ordered this new translation of the Bible to be written by a committee. And it was a lot of negotiations, because the original in Greek and Hebrew, there's a whole lot of it where you can translate it this way or you can translate it that way. And so there's a lot of negotiations about how Protestant a translation it should be. But when it came out, the King James Bible, it's still today the most widely used translation of the Bible, and also is a literary masterpiece, it has to be said. Which takes us up to 1625, and it's going to be next week that we're going to go onto the Civil War. So I'm going to stop.